Okay. So my objective in the next lecture is to introduce the BRST method and to apply it to the quantization of the strings. Now, rather than just getting directly to the BRST, I would like to just describe some slightly more general setup of cohomological quantum field theory, of which the BRST technology is a special example. So the cohomological quantum field theory is something which is defined in the following way. We start from a quantum field theory, which is equipped to the with a fermionic symmetry. So fermionic symmetry is a symmetry which relates bosons and fermions in your theory. Now, I take this to be a scalar. Now, you can immediately complain that bosons are scalars, vectors, and so on, and fermions are spinors. So you cannot possibly have a scalar symmetry between them. So the very fact that we're discussing this symmetry means that the original symmetry theory was not a unitary theory. There are going to be some fermionic degrees of freedoms which are scalars, or some bosonic degrees of freedoms which are spinors. So this theory is not a very old theory on its own. I would require the symmetry to also be nilpotent. See, when you have a bosonic symmetry, so you can take the commutator of them to get a new symmetry. So bosonic symmetries form a Lie algebra, typically. You can do the same with fermionic symmetries, except you take the anti-commutator. And which means that even if you have one of them, you can still square it and get a bosonic symmetry. And I want this bosonic symmetry to be trivial. So the setup is that I have a theory with a fermionic symmetry which squares to zero. The setup allows me to discuss something analogous to cohomology. What do I mean? Let me just say that being a symmetry means that if I have a correlation function of something which is the image of the symmetry, this is zero. This is true for any symmetry, not just fermionic ones. Right? This is what tells us the correlation function. If I have a symmetry, correlation functions of a whole bunch of operators are non-zero, only if these operators are the product of these operators is neutral. You cannot, in a theory with a U1 symmetry, you cannot have an expectation value for an operator of charge U1 unless the symmetry is broken. So let's say that I have a assuming that this symmetry is unbroken, both in the theory and in the vacuum of the theory. So not I want the symmetry to be unbroken spontaneously. Not to be spontaneously broken. Sorry. Okay. Then suppose I consider a correlation functions of operators which are Q closed, which are invariant under the symmetry. So when an operator is invariant under the symmetry, I call this operator Q closed. So if I have a correlation function of a bunch of Q closed operators, and then one operator which is in the image of Q, then this correlation function will vanish, simply because I can consider this quantity, which is zero, and then apply Leibniz rule to distribute Q on the various factors. It kills all the Q-closed operators, and it gives me this. So an operator which is in the image of uh, So another operator is called Q exact. So we just learned, notice that a Q exact operator is in particular Q closed, because Q square is zero. So we learned that if, as long as our theory is Q invariant, our vacuum is Q invariant, and we look at correlation functions of Q invariant operators, then Q exact operators will drop out of our calculations. So we can sort of define a new theory, which is sort of the cohomology of the old theory, where the operators are the Q closed operators in the old theory modulo the Q exact operators. So we compute correlation functions in the old theory, but only of this subset of operators. And we throw away some of them. This defines a new theory. It's perfectly possible that although this theory, the original theory was somewhat sick because it had ghosts, it had scalar fermions or, you know, bosonic spinners, the new theory might be fine. It's possible that all the troubles to the old theory are eliminated in the process. On the other hand, this construction will allow us sometimes to define theories which are cumbersome to define directly. So it's sometimes the case that this theory can be simple to define. For example, it could be defined as an actual quantization of classical fields, while the same is not possible here. Indeed, this is the case in gauge theory. Why do we need gauge symmetries? We need gauge symmetries because we are trying to build a theory which has a certain irreducible representation of the Poincaré group, the photon. But if we want to do it by quantizing classical fields, we have to use irreducible representation of Lorentz group at each point. And unfortunately, that does not give us all irreducible representation of the Poincaré group. So if I quantize a gauge boson, I get spurious degrees of freedom. And I need to get rid of them. The idea of the Bieresti quantization is to add some extra fermionic degrees of freedom, which are related to the gauge degrees of freedom by this fermionic symmetry. And then taking cohomology sort of eliminates both these extra ghosts and the original gauge degrees of freedom, leaving behind only the physical degrees of freedom. And allows you to do so without breaking Lorentz symmetry, which is quite convenient. Now, more generally, the Bieresti formalism or generalizations called the BV formalism are useful whenever you're trying to quantize a constrained system. Some situation, so if your phase space is complicated, it can be very difficult to quantize the theory. But sometimes you can embed this complicated phase space into a standard linear phase space, cutting it out by some constraints. You can express these constraints by doing this sort of fermionic symmetries, by adding fermionic degrees of freedom and using these fermionic symmetries. Then you can usually quantize things in the bigger linear space and obtain a theory which describes the more complicated phase space. Okay, so now to motivate the term cohomological, yes?
Sorry, by the product, you mean really the product or the commutator?
Yeah.
Where?
When you write products of operators, you mean the commutator or
no? I just.
So what do you mean by Leibniz rule here?
Hmm?
What do you mean by Leibniz rule here?
I mean that if I have Q of AB, that's Q of A times B, plus or minus, depending on the fermion number of A, A Q of B. So when I have a symmetry, typically I define it in such a way that it acts on products by acting on individual terms. You know, Q is an infinitesimal transformation. So the infinitesimal variation of AB is the infinitesimal variation of A times B plus A times the infinitesimal variation of B. So if I apply it here, I get several terms. And I get Q of O1, O2, and so on, plus N plus one other terms. That's another term.
Mm-hmm. Q is one of those usual charges we have that generate symmetries. It acts.
Yes, it acts precisely as. Well, sorry, no. In which sense do symmetries act as?
If you want to translate an operator, you act with the commutator with the momentum on the operator. That's the value, the translation of the operator.
Oh, yes, yes. No, that's right. You're right. Sorry. That's what you mean. Yes, when I say Q acting on operator. So you can imagine it as commutator with something. Actually, more precisely, it's a quantum field theory, so there will be a current, a Beresti current, and that's right. So the Beresti operator is the integral of the current, and the action on another operator is commutator with this charge, or integrating the current around the operator, and so on. So that's right. So this relation can be thought of as Jacobi, if you think about Q as taking an anticommutator with something. That's right. Okay. So I can give you toy examples of the structure without going into full quantum field theory, path integrals. We can find a lot of fine examples already just looking at standard integrals. So let me study a few zero-dimensional quantum field theories. So what's the simplest thing I can do? I can have some bosonic variables and some fermionic variables. I should make sure that my thetas and my q's are different. Oh, that's all right. Okay. I used to have better thetas. Okay. And then define my symmetry by saying that Q acting on Xi is theta j. It is theta I. And then Q acting on theta I is 0. So in particular, Q squared is 0. These bosonic variables could be valued in Rn, but it can also be valued in the manifold. So these Xi could be local coordinates in some space X. Let me make sure this is sensible. Suppose I transform Xi to be a function of some other variables in a different coordinate patch. Then, actually, let me do it the other way. Then let's try to figure out what the variation of this Xi should be, or these new variables should be. We apply Leibniz, so we get something like this. I can just define this to be theta tilde j's. So you see that you can patch up together patches like this, but it's sort of coordinate transformation. So a good way, mathematical way to say this is that the pair of fx and thetas defines a point in a sort of variance of the tangent bundle of x, where the fiber is fermionic. This is usually called pi t of x. So now that we have this set up, let's compute some path integrals, which means just ordinary integrals. So my typical calculation would be an integral over this whole space. Of a bunch of functions of x and theta. Notice that the Jacobian, the x's transform, if you look at the transformation, the x transformed by the determinant of the Jacobian, the theta transform exactly in the opposite way. So this quantity is invariant. So under this coordinates, dx d theta, the measure is equal to dx tilde d theta tilde. So in order to define this integral, I don't need to pick a measure on the manifold. I don't need to pick a metric. So it's the first hint that the sort of the setup is going to be topological. Now, what are the Q-closed operators? Now, have you done enough Grassmann integrals to feel comfortable with them? Okay. So when I do this integral to get something on zero, I pick the terms which have as exactly as many thetas as d thetas. And then I do the bosonic integral that is left. So what are the Q-closed operators? So let's be fully explicit. What does a function of x and theta mean? It means the sum of terms of this form. So how does Q act on it? Well, it acts on the x's, I apply Leibniz, and adds a theta. So the Q-closed expressions are those for which this derivative, anti-symmetrized over all indices, vanishes. On the other hand, the Q-exact operators are operators which are obtained from some other functions by taking a derivative and anti-symmetrizing. Can you recognize this structure? Where have you seen expressions like this, taking a derivative and then anti-symmetrizing?
Forms.
Yes. That's right. So there is a one-to-one correspondence between observables in this theory and forms on X. So I call forms are expressions that look like this. And we identify them with these observables. And this operation is just called this O of F. So this operation, when I write it, O of df is just Q of O of f. So acting with a Bierstadt charge is the same as taking the exterior derivative of the forms. So Q-closed operators are closed forms. Q-exact operators are exact forms. if you look at what integral is, this integral is, sorry, if I take the integral of O of F1, O of F2, and so on, the theta integral will strip off the thetas, and then we can just replace them with x's. So this is just the same as the integral over x over the bosonic manifold of the wedge of the forms. And you might remember that integrals of closed forms are topological in nature. They capture topological information about the manifold. In other words, this quantum field theory studies the cohomology of the manifold. The observables are cohomology classes in the manifold. They are closed form module exact forms. And the correlation functions are integrals of cohomology classes on your manifold. And the theory of cohomology is quite robust, meaning if you take your manifold and you deform it in various ways, it remains the same. And also behaves in interesting ways when you map manifolds into each other and so on. All of those statements can be understood in this language. So concretely, what happened here is that these extra fermionic variables healed all the continuous information in the axis. All that was left is the overall topology of the manifold. So it's an example of how the fermionic variables can be used to cancel bosonic variables. Now, of course, this is not a great quantum field theory. For example, it's a quantum field theory whose partition function is zero. Because if I don't put observables, I have nothing to saturate my thetas against. So to get something that resembles more closely a partition function, we could add extra fermionic variables and bosonic variables and try to add an action. Any questions? Now, if you haven't seen cohomology, probably this is not was not terribly illuminating. How many of you have seen cohomology? OK, so this was probably not illuminating in the sense of illuminating quantum field theory. Perhaps this might illuminate cohomology for you when you study cohomology. You're saying, ah, I'm just doing VRST quantization. Maybe I can give, if I can give some useful examples, but for example, suppose my manifold was a circle. Let's try to figure out which closed forms do we have. Which observables do we have? Well, let's look for functions first. Let me call the variable in the circle phi. So the condition for a function to be Q-closed is that the phi, so if I act with Q, I get phi f theta. The condition for this to be closed is that f is independent of phi. So the only Q-closed observables of this sort is 1. Next, I can look for forms called G. One forms. So Q of a one form is always 0, just because I'm adding an extra theta. Theta is fermionic, and theta squared is 0. On the other hand, so all one forms are Q-closed. Now, which ones are exact, though. All those for which G is a total derivative. Can you find some function on the circle which is not the derivative of another function? Go on. Give me a continuous function on the circle, which is not the derivative of the continuous function. Or alternatively, let's look at gauge invariant quantities. What's the right? If I have a one form, I can compute the expectation, the expectation value of the corresponding operator, which is the integral of g of phi over the circle. If this integral is non-zero, then clearly my form was not Q-exact. So anything which gives me a non-zero integral cannot be Q-exact. In particular, anything which is a total derivative integrates to zero. So a representative for closed forms is just defi theta. So theta is closed, but not exact. Every other function of this sort, I can just subtract from it the integral of g times theta and get something which is exact. So the cohomology consists of just 1 and theta. And the correlation, only correlation function is that because a function of 1 times 1 times 1 times theta is non-zero, is 1, well, 2 pi, and everything else is 0. So all that all the information that is contained in this is that the circle had only one connected component, which is the information contained here. And it was a circle, not a line. Now, for a line, I could have just used, theta would have been q of phi, q of x. But on the circle, the function x, the function phi, does not exist on a circle. Phi is a local coordinate, it's not a function. And because phi is missing among the functions, I find a non-trivial one form. I suggested you do the same exercise for the sphere. If you do the exercise for the sphere, you'll find that there is again one. There is no one form, but there is a two form, which is the measure of this on the sphere. And again, so that is encoding the fact that a sphere has one connected component. It has no contractible, all loops are contractible, and has a non-contractible cycle. It's an interesting topological structure. In each local patch, the thetas cancel the x's completely. But the only thing that is left is the global way these patches are glued together.
When you say they cancel the x's, do you mean like x equals the circle part or what?
No, I mean that. If you look at functions So operators are globally defined functions. If you're looking at just functions restricted to each patch, there will be no cohomology. You know, every function, the thetas and the x's would completely cancel each other. Each function of x times thetas, which is closed, would also be exact. But when you work on a manifold, then there is some restriction on how your functions are built, right? Your functions are built from local functions which agree patchwise. So you're sort of losing a few functions compared to looking at the product of patches. And this losing a few functions creates a mismatch between Q exact and Q closed things and allows something to survive. Now, in order to understand a little bit better what survives and what forms capture, it's good to learn that forms can be integrated over submanifolds. And that there is sort of a relation between submanifolds in your manifold and forms. So to do so, I want to just introduce a slightly more complicated quantum field theory. I mean, ultimately, a lot of these things can be understood best just by trying several examples until you get an intuition for what's going on. And it's better to do it with these examples than to do it with the BRST quantized gauge theory. So in the next toy model, so I'm going to keep the same variables there. But I'm going to add an extra pair. So this is going to be a fermion, and this is going to be a boson. And instead of having the boson transform into the fermion, I have the fermion transform into the boson. Now, a nice feature of having a fermion transforming into a boson is that it gives me a simple way to build an action, which is Q, which is annihilated by Q, which is symmetric. I just take an expression like B times a function of X, and I act with Q on it. What do I get? I get capital B as f of x plus little b, plus theta b dx of f. Okay. So now let me consider an integral where, besides my usual observables, I'm adding an action. Notice that in order to be Q-closed, my operators typically don't contain B, right? Because if they contain B, then Q would act non-trivially on them. And if they contain B by something like this, by combining with some other, they're typically Q-exact. So the observables I'm going to insert here are still going to be essentially functions of x and theta, more or less. Okay. So what happens if I do the path the integral over these b's? Well, the part integral of capital B gives me a delta function. The part integral of a little b pulls down a theta df. Okay. So this integral becomes an integral of this sort. So clearly now we have an integral over a submanifold. The submanifold where f equal to 0. Yes. Uh-huh. And then also the integral over theta will cancel one of the, can cancel against one of the thetas in the integration. Now, the interesting part is that if you just integrate, so let's do this properly. Inserting a delta function into an integral introduces a normally dependence on the measure. And with, so, I mean, has risks making an integral not topological. Why? For example, recall so what happens if I have some integral from g of x, you know, from minus infinity to infinity, delta of f of x, dx. Do you know the answer to this?
What do you mean when you say that integrals of closed forms are topological?
Oh. At this point, I'm not saying much except the fact that this integral did not require a choice of metric. So if I'm integrating on a sphere, it doesn't matter if it was a sphere or if it was a football. But now it's going to become a bit more clear what I mean. So who knows how to do this integral? OK, what's the answer?
Sum over g of the zeros of f of x divided by the.
That's right. So sum over f, the points where f equal to 0.
Of g evaluated at
right.
Zeros.
G evaluated at the zeros.
Divided over the norm of f prime at the zeros.
That's right. Norm of the f at the zeros. Right. Now this is bothersome. In a sense, he's trying to tell you that, you know, when you do integral. Usually integrals are invariant under reparametrization. I mean, these integrals, right? Invariant under changes of coordinates. But here I'm getting a factor which seems to depend on the specific local coordinate I used. Well, but notice that this construction automatically dressed up the delta function by the derivative of f. So if you integrate g of x derivative of f times delta of f, right? This will cancel that up to signs. So you get something like a sum over the zeros of f of counted with signs, the value of g at the fixed points. So this is a much more topological expression, right? It only cares about the value of g at the zeros of f. So it really has transformed the integral over a line to an integral over a bunch of points with a sign that tells you what was the sign of the Jacobian from those points. So the same is true here. This insertion here is precisely what you need to completely reduce the integral of forms on the manifold to the integral of forms on the submanifold. Now something very nice happens. The action I used was Q exact. So suppose I change f by a little bit. I send f to f plus delta f. Right? All that I'm doing is to insert a q delta f here. But that vanishes. So this must be invariant under the formation of F. So let me draw a picture. Right, I'm running out of blackboards. I have my ambient manifold. I have some submanifold defined by f of x equal to 0. And I found a way to do integrals on this submanifold in such a way that the answer does not actually depend on how this submanifold is embedded. So I could integrate over other submanifolds which are continuous deformation of the original one, and I will get the same answer. For example, from this, I immediately learned that if I was working with a sphere and I was integrating one form on one manifold, the answer will always be 0 because these one manifolds can always be contracted away somewhere on the sphere. Right. On the other hand, on the circle, I was getting a non-zero answer because there is no way to contract away the circle within the circle. So here we're starting to see topological invariance in a stronger sense. And you see that this theory of forms is capturing topological information. So you can generalize this construction in several interesting ways. You could add multiple auxiliary ghosts, which allow you to set multiple functions to 0. So that you have an integral on a manifold, you impose a constraint, you impose another constraint, and integrate on a manifold of dimension 2.
Can you repeat why it's invariant on the dimension of F?
Because if I change F to some f prime, which is close to it, I do f goes to f plus delta f. Okay. Then at the leaning order, I can just pull down delta f. And I'm getting, so the variation of this integral is a correlation function involving q of b delta f. But that's exact. Now, you might not want to do something as dramatic as setting f to 0, right? Because then your integration over capital B will become ill-defined. So the whole action is Q-exact, but I cannot just get rid of the whole action because it's making the path integral defined. but I can still deform it continuously. I could even take these B's to be sections of non-trivial bundles of the manifold, so that the locus is defined not by a zero of a collection of functions, but zeros of sections of some bundles. So this allows you to build very general submanifolds. Now, another thing you can observe is that if you put as many B's as thetas, then you're imposing as many constraints as the dimension of your manifold, you'll be reduced to an integration over points. Also, it means that you have brought down as many thetas as the thetas here, so that the action will be able to sort of provide enough thetas and b's to cancel out all the integration measure, which means that you'll be able to have correlation functions where there are no operator insertions at all. So that's a more interesting theory. It will have a partition function, which is just the sum over the number of points up to signs. Now, there is a way to keep track of this cancellation or not cancellation of the of how many thetas do you need in your operators in order to get something on zero. Right. Now, the number of thetas is equal to the number of the thetas minus the number of the b's. This action I wrote has a hidden symmetry, which is called Gauss number symmetry. So suppose I give Gauss number plus 1 to this and minus 1 to little b. Right. Then clearly the action is invariant on the Gauss number. But the measure might or not be. It will be invariant under Gauss number symmetry if you have as many little b's as thetas. So the anomaly for this Gauss number symmetry will tell, which means the mismatch between the b's and the thetas, will tell you how many thetas or b's you need to have in your operators in order to get the correlation function, which is not zero. This will be important in our string theoretical collections because it will often be the case that there is a slight mismatch. And we need to make sure that there are the correct number of b's or thetas in our integral. Okay. Now I believe we have all the information we need to do BRST gauge fixing. I will begin and then complete tomorrow. So in a station you have a gauge symmetry, it means that you have some space of field configurations. And there are some directions which are redundant. Which are the gauge orbits. Right? For example, when we're looking at this particle, relativistic particle, we wanted to study the space of ways the particle could propagate in space-time, but the only convenient way we could find is to study maps from the real line into space-time. And there were some extra degrees of freedom there that were spurious, which was the actual way you parameterize your trajectory in space-time. So in that case, that would have been reparametrization. The whole space is a space of maps from R to the spacetime. When you study gauge symmetry, the total space is the space of configuration for the gauge connection, and these orbits are the space of gauge transformations for the connection. So are connections related by gauge transformations. And when you do a path integral, gauge fixing means that you're trying to do a path integral where you don't count all these configurations the same way, but rather, you try to pick to select one configuration in each gauge orbit. So gauge fixing means to sort of try to get rid of the gauge symmetry by fixing. For every gauge orbit, you find a gauge fixed connection, a connection with a very specific form which has no more gauge symmetry. And when you try to do so globally and in quantum mechanically, it's easy to encounter all sorts of troubles in trying to do so. Things would become much better if the gauge orbits were topological, if our calculations were topological along gauge orbits. Right? Because then we would be certain that it doesn't really matter how we cut, as long as things are topological along these directions. So in BRST quantization, you might make the gauge orbits topological by doing this. So you're going to add thetas, the equivalent of thetas, which are paired up with the gauge transformations. We're not going to add thetas for all our degrees of freedom, but only for the gauge degrees of freedom. So, right. So the basic idea is that we want the BRST transformation acting on our coordinates to live along the gauge orbits. So suppose the gauge orbits are associated with some. So concretely, right, I'll pick some vector fields, which are the direction of my gauge transformations. So this VI is just the gauge transformation acting on X, the eighth gauge transformation acting on X. And I try to, and these Cs are some new fermionic variables. So my variables are X's and C's. These could be functions of X. Okay. So let's try to make sure that we have an actual symmetry, which is nilpotent. So let's compute Q squared of X. Well, of course, we need to decide how Q acts on C. But let's keep going for now. So when I act here, I get the derivative of V. And then I'll have an extra term, which is the variation of the C's. No. So I'll be able to set this to zero only if this quantity, right, can be re-expressed in terms of this. Now, if you stare at this expression a little bit, you recognize that this is the Lie bracket. So this is a true vector. This is a vector field. Let me call this VA. Right? She remembered the Lie bracket of true vector fields. Actually, I don't know if you've ever seen the Lie bracket. You might have seen the Lie bracket. Did you ever see the Lie bracket of vector fields? Okay, good. Then this is precisely this expression. Anti-symmetrized. Now, when we have symmetries, the Lie bracket of two symmetries is usually another symmetry. Now, let's assume for simplicity that the structure constants are not functions of X. If they are functions of X, then things get more complicated. You get into possibly intricate versions of BRST quantization or BV quantization. But for now, let me just take this to be constants. So, right, so this is just FCAB. Okay. CB, CA, VC, I. So we learn how to transform the C's in such a way that Q squared is zero. So we need to select Q of C to be f of ABC, CB, CC. Next, we need to make sure that Q square of C is zero. Now, when you compute Q square of C, you end up with some bilinear expression of the Fs multiplying three Cs. And if you stare at it, you'll recognize that this is just Jacobi identity for the structural constants. So from this definition, it already follows that this vanishes. OK, so we have a well-defined setup. And we could study the cohomological quantum field theory associated to this. Think mathematically, this is called Lie algebra cohomology. And indeed, it's used for doing exactly these sort of things, integrating over gauge orbits in a manifold instead of integrating over the manifold. So in particular, if you look at observables, functions of x, when are functions of x q closed? Well, for example, when they are gauge invariant. So gauge invariant functions of x are going to be examples of observables. If you look at forms, you'll essentially find gauge invariant forms, modulo forms which point along the orbit, and so on and so forth. Okay. And what you need to do in integral like this now is to just add your gauge fixing constraints in this manner. If you add your gauge fixing constraints in this manner, then you'll be confident that the answer will be independent of your gauge fixing, at least under continuous deformations of the gauge fixing. So whatever worries you might have will be just topological worries. It might really catch in the whole space, say. Okay, so we'll do the, now in the next lecture, we'll just do the textbook derivation of BRSD and match it with this. Is there anything else? I don't think there is anything I need to say now. Any questions? Okay.